Extracurricular in Particular,
a podcast from Dr. Stan Chernikov.
Welcome back, my friends of Extracurricular in Particular. This is the 9th episode, I believe, in our journey together to help you figure out how to be extraordinary in your university life. The last time we visited, we chatted about the mysteries of year one, when you first arrive on campus, and how to have a very successful year. Just to summarize for a moment, year one is supposed to be a year of exploration, and I hope that you'll be pursuing that if you haven't already. A time to develop the kind of skills that will serve you well all throughout college, connect with other students to study with, to socialize with, and certainly connect with your professors, because as you'll see now, you're going to need them for a variety of different reasons. So we can move from year one to years two and three, kind of the core time of your years in college, and kind of focus on the kinds of things that happened during those years. When you return to college in year number two, it's really a wonderful time because you know your campus now. You're not lost all the time. You know the best places to eat. You know where you can work out and exercise. You know where you can study. Most importantly, you're just not a clueless first-year student anymore. And if you've been paying attention at all, you've begun to build those wonderful relationships with a substantial number of faculty members and other advisors on campus. We've talked about how you select your courses, and I hope you've compiled the names of the great professors who you haven't studied with yet from your friends and from just the word on the street on campus, because you'd be wanting to take some of those classes during years two and three. You still want to try to achieve that special balance in each semester between the courses that challenge you in one way versus the courses that challenge you in others, reading versus quantitative reasoning and those types of things. And you may, during years two and three, beginning to enroll in the second class, the follow-up class, because something really sparked your interest in year one and you want to try to explore that in year two in greater depth. This is the time that you explore in order to try to figure out what you may be majoring in. So we'll talk about majoring, but just realize coming back to campus year two is really an exciting time because you're not a first-year student anymore and you're not lost. You should be more relaxed. Let me begin with a suggestion. This is a suggestion that very few students ever hear. And of all of the insider advice tips that I have for you in this podcast, this might actually be the most important. So take a deep breath, because I'm going to try to tell you something now that I really think is critical for you to be successful for the remainder of your college years. I believe very deeply that you should be reconnecting with your favorite professors from year one. Now, you may not be taking a class from them year two or year three, but you love them and you love their course in year one, and you want to maintain that relationship. So let me give you a little scenario. You've taken a course your first semester on campus, and it turns out, luck of the draw, the professor in that course turns out to be your absolutely favorite professor of your entire college years. Now it's your senior year, and you've never taken a follow-up course from that professor. Perhaps she teaches in an area that is not your major, or you haven't chosen to take an elective in that area. But you need a critical letter of recommendation for graduate school, for a massive fellowship that will pay you an enormous stipend, for a paid internship, which we'll talk a little bit more later, or perhaps even for your first post-college job. You need letters of recommendation from someone. Your favorite professor was year one, but you didn't pay attention to my advice. So it turns out, 4 years later, when you're a senior, the relationship with that professor may at best be dormant. You haven't seen them for 4 years. And realize, thousands of students have passed through their classes during this four-year period. So while you may have had a great relationship and visited them during their office hours and built something special, if it's not sustained, it tends to go away. And that's something that you don't want to happen. So imagine you need this special letter of recommendation. You're standing outside their office, you're holding the recommendation form, you're perspiring profusely because you're really worried, will she remember me? Will he remember me? There is no guarantees of this. So as you summon the courage to walk in, realize this: had you paid attention to what I think is one of the most important things I can teach you, you wouldn't be feeling this level of anxiety. Because every year after you come back, you check in with your professors who you like the most. You let them know what you did. You let them know if you traveled, if you had an internship, if you studied abroad. You keep them current on who you are and what your journey has been. Because ultimately, when they write a letter of recommendation for you, they want a really robust amount of information that they can talk about who you are and how you've evolved as a student and a person. This can only happen if every autumn you check in with them, make an appointment, and just tell them, here's what I've done this summer, here's what I'm planning to do this year, and perhaps I hope to take a class with you this year. So my key advice here: don't leave these matters to chance or to the sharpness of the professor's memory. You may remember them, but they've had thousands of students between the time you saw them last. Don't hope that they remember you. You may hear this time and time again while you're in college, that hope is not a strategy. Hoping they remember you is not the same as ensuring that they remember you. So never find yourself in this uncomfortable situation. What I want you to realize is this: for them to recommend you in a powerful way, they want to be able to talk about you currently, not you 4 years ago when you were a first year student. They want to be able to talk about things that are going on now. And while you're visiting with them, updating them on all the wonderful things that have happened to you, you can then begin to inquire about their field again, new advances that have taken place since you studied with them, opportunities that may exist for them to collaborate with you, opportunities for you to volunteer in their work, opportunities to go and hear lecture series in their departments. Because again, year two and year three is when you're beginning to dive more deeply into your studies and hopefully find your major. And reconnecting with a professor who was your favorite, teaching you a subject that was your favorite, is an opportunity to say, perhaps this would be a great major for me. Let me explore it more deeply with my mentor. So this kind of advice, almost never told to anyone, is, I think, golden. Go back and see your favorite professors every year. It's the nice thing to do. It's the right thing to do. And it will make you unforgettable. Remember, you want to be extraordinary and unforgettable. And this is the way you achieve that. Okay, so it's year two, or perhaps year three, more likely two. It's time to pick a major. Might not be right at the beginning of year two, might begin to lap over into year three, but this is a very big decision for you. What subject has captivated you? Essentially, when you pick your major, you're picking your post-college career, at least the first one. Now, this doesn't apply to everyone, but it applies to a lot of you. So if you major in business or you major in computer science, there's a strong likelihood that you are going to go into business or to computers. So selecting your major is kind of a weighty decision. And we often make those decisions with incorrect or insufficient amount of information. Somebody told you you should major in this. Maybe mom and dad want you to major in something. I've dealt with students many times over the years where mom and dad wanted you to major in this and you wanted to major in that. And problems arise under those circumstances. You want to be armed when you're defending your decision with as much information on why it's a great decision, why you will have a great career and be successful in your life. So as is always the case, when you have an information gap, when you need information, to make a good decision, there are people on campus to go to, not only your buddies, but advisors, and again, I'm recommending this, your favorite professors who are there to help mentor you whenever you need. So you pick their brains about why they selected their field. And if you're interested in their field, they can go very deeply in that. But realize this, as we discussed earlier on another installment of our podcast, there's a need sometimes to be resilient. There's a need sometimes to be able to, as we say, fail forward. Things don't go exactly according to plan for everyone and all the time. You came to college wholly expecting to walk right through the front door of the computer science department. You were expecting to major in computer science, or you were certain you could major in engineering or in business. All of these are highly competitive majors. So your anticipation that you get to walk through the door to computer science, there's a crowd of 2,000 other students who have that very similar, almost identical expectation. You're not all going to get in. At this point, in picking a major, if your first choice becomes unavailable to you, which sometimes it does, you have to figure out ways to be resilient, figure out ways to pivot. And as I say time and again, the best people to talk to when a decision like this or a problem like this arises are your favorite professors and the advisors on campus. Not only the advisors in central advising, but advisors in the individual departments that may interest you. So imagine that you've struggled to get into, let's say, engineering. You've always wanted to be an engineer. And it's so competitive that your admission is denied. Should you give up? I would argue no. I would argue you reapply. But before you reapply, you may want to go and have conversations with advisors in engineering and with professors in engineering, because you'd like to figure out how you can make a better case for your admission, what you might need to study, what might you need to improve in your portfolio before you can apply again. I don't want you ever to just give up. Doesn't work that way, and it shouldn't. But you need strategies. And as I said before, hope is not a strategy. So you need to be proactive and talk to people about these things. The closed door to a major is not one of the high points of your college career. But your advisors will tell you there are many other open doors on campus for you, dozens of them. And they will tell you that there are many pathways to a career, for example, in business, that isn't the direct path, let's say, of being just a business major. So many people who end up being successful in business end up being English majors and history majors and chemistry majors. They just go on and get a master's in business and don't have an undergraduate degree in business. And that's very possible. Or of course, you may pivot to another field that is similar to business, like economics. There are side doors when the front door is closed, and the advisors on campus know where all the side doors are located. So you certainly should be exploring all of these things. Don't give up on your dreams. If the first choice is not available, then find ways to pursue other choices. There are great opportunities on campus. That said, if your first choice does not work out, you can't just drift taking course after course unrelated to a major. Most universities eventually will be very proactive in nudging you towards selecting a major. Some of them will be gentle, a little reminder at registration time. Others will be not so gentle, saying, you got to pick a major before you get to this number of credits, or else you go on some type of probation. When you are uncertain, you can continue the process of exploration. For example, your favorite class first year, favorite professor, favorite class, best grade. But you didn't think you'd ever consider majoring in that field. Maybe you took it as a general education requirement. Maybe it was an elective. Now you're saying to yourself, well, the door has closed to my choice of major. It might be time, since you liked the first course so well, to go back to that professor, make an appointment, and explore with the professor What are the choices in that field? What are the other courses you should follow up with? One final note about your major, and this will sound strange to some of you. Once you declare a major, you've actually begun the exciting path towards the completion of that major, and you actually are beginning your professional career in that field. Students are always puzzled when I say, so you want to be a doctor, and you've taken anatomy and physiology as a first or second year student. In my opinion, you've begun to be a doctor for the simple reason that what you learn in anatomy class, even if it's an undergraduate anatomy class, will be the foundational knowledge you'll be using as a doctor 20 years from now. If you understand the human body through your anatomy class, it's clear that you'll continue to use that knowledge. So when you pick a major, it might be something like business. You take an accounting class and you say, well, I just want to get a good grade in accounting and proceed in my major. But it turns out the principles that you learn in accounting 101, are the same principles you'll be using at as a certified public accountant working for a big corporation. Don't be thinking only about the grade this semester and completing the acquisition of knowledge in a certain subject. Think of your future and your use of that knowledge later on in your life, because I can guarantee what you learn in college in your deep major classes will be used forever in whatever career you select. So don't limit yourself in thinking that way and consider yourself on a continuum to that career once you get on the path by selecting that major. Does that make sense to you? I hope so. One second and third year. Those are the ideal times to begin to explore the whole concept of internships, whether they be paid, which is the ideal state, or whether they be unpaid. These are the keys to the kingdom. There are a few better ways to explore a potential major and a potential career than applying for and securing a summer internship related to that field of study. Here you get the hands-on exposure to what life will be like as a professional in that area. And if you get paid, that's even better. You can even undertake an internship during a year, during a semester. In fact, most universities now offer something called experiential learning. They give you credit to go out and explore, maybe even get paid in an internship environment because you're learning on the job. But in all probability, you're going to have to write some sort of paper or report that will explain what experiences you had in that internship. If you do experiential learning through the auspices of an internship, realize you're probably going to need a faculty sponsor. If this is a credit-bearing internship where the university is giving you 3 credits or 5 credits towards your degree, they'll want a faculty person to supervise. All the more reason to maintain great relationships with faculty, because faculty will only sponsor students that they know, that they admire. Ultimately, they're going to have to read some sort of report or paper that you write. It does constitute extra work above their usual teaching load and their research requirements, but they'll do this for their favorite students who have maintained a connection to them, as I've been arguing. And as they do this, they only do it for their favorite students. They will not do it for strangers. You can't go into a professor sight unseen and say, will you be my sponsor or supervisor of an internship? They almost never will do that. But the professors you go and visit after year one, they'll know you, they'll remember you, and they'll be eager to support your work. The most scholarly students on campus are always on the lookout for their next great internship. There's always opportunities. And these are, of course, powerful resume builders. So you're just beginning to develop a professional resume. And ultimately, they may help you get a job because you've begun working in that field. They also will help you gain admission to a graduate program because you've gone much more deeply than just coursework into that type of activity. And of course, getting an internship that will secure for you admission to graduate school may come with it a stipend that pays you a living wage while you're in graduate school, and we'll talk about that in a little while. What I argue now is you should try an internship just about every year. Might be in the summertime, might be during the semesters. Try not to let a year go by without you having that type of experience. It's better than just going to class all the time. Year two, more likely year three. You're beginning to think about life after your first undergraduate experience. You're thinking perhaps about graduate school or professional schools. It just may be a thought, it may be a dream at this point, but it's never too early to start. If your goal is a professional degree, doctor, dentist, law degree, any of those types of things, it is never too early to start thinking and planning for the application process. You're not applying. You're not sending away for applications. You're not downloading them and printing them out and filling them out. But you're thinking, this is the path that I hope to follow. Most graduate and professional programs, law, medicine, dentistry, engineering, nursing, master's in teaching, all of them require letters of recommendation from at least one, and often as many as three, professors who have had you as a student in their class, not your TA. It has to be the professor. So I usually pose to students, especially in their second and third year, the following scenario. You need a letter of recommendation today. Something has come along. A great paid internship, a dream study abroad program, a scholarship that will change your entire financial picture for the rest of your college days. But you need to get it in within 48 hours. Do you have a former professor who would do such a thing for you on such short notice? If you can't answer yes, then you haven't really built the relationships you need on this campus. Because you need to have the support of someone who would, in a sense, drop everything to help you achieve your goals and your dreams. If you're going to be applying to graduate and professional school, you need to begin to strategize for how to get professors to support your efforts. And of course, that relates to you keeping up those relationships. So let's talk letters of recommendation for a little while. Professors are busy. Aren't we all? Students are busy, professors are busy, of course. But they do understand that it's part of their profession to mentor students, to support their goals, and to be willing to write on their behalf. If they know you. Again, professors will rarely write letters of recommendation for students they don't know. So if you're planning to ask for letters of recommendation, be thoughtful and ask in advance, because few professors have the time or the inclination to drop everything they're doing to craft a strong and supported letter. You will need to have a great relationship with a professor if you're going to give them a short timeline, but you need to have a strong relationship with any professor from whom you're asking a letter of recommendation. When you ask for a letter, give the professor some time to write it. Rule of thumb is that you want to give them at least 2 weeks, if not 4 or 5, to prepare them. So imagine you're applying to law school and you're applying to 4 or 5 or 6 different law schools, which would require a specific letter addressed to those law schools. And there may be different focus for each one of those letters if you want them to be customized. This takes a great deal of the professor's time writing letters of recommendation. Now, the right-thinking, student-centric types of professors, and you know who they are already, they remember the time when their professors took the effort and the time to write on their behalf. That's how they got where they are today. It's time for them to pay it forward to you, but they will do it for their best students, the ones they admire the most. So try to be that student. All of the things we've told you up till now are building towards this moment, because you've built relationships, you've done more than just the assigned work, and the professor thinks You're the best students they've had in years. And that will shine through in your letter of recommendation. Professors will also want to see some kind of personal statement that kind of elaborates on your professional goals. So prepare in advance a one-pager, something that will say, this is what I plan to do in graduate school, perhaps in professional school, and then on into my career. Often the actual application process will ask for a professional statement, so you're going to have to do it in any event. It's nice. I know when I write a letter of recommendation for a student, I love to see them explain to me and express in their own words what their goals are so that I can support those goals and I can kind of lift certain things, certain ideas from their personal statement and emphasize them in my letter that supports them. So a word about your personal statement. I know that perfection is typically unattainable, but you should be shooting for a flawless personal statement because it's basically announcing to the world who you are, how you feel about yourself, and what your quality is. Never just write something down without having a trusted advisor, highly qualified friends or relatives. Maybe it's your TA, maybe it's your resident advisor in your residence hall, maybe it's a professor, but they should read your statement, correct any spelling, correct any grammar, make sure that you're using the right word choice and the right logic. Essentially, you want the overall quality of your personal statement to be of the highest quality of anything you've ever produced, because the stakes are very high. It may determine if you get into graduate school. It may determine if you get graduate school paid for. So you do not want to do shoddy work here. And a great scholar never submits anything like this type of project without it being their very best work. Another bit of information about letters of recommendation that almost no one will ever tell you. You're celebrating and congratulating yourself that you've got three professors who will write on your behalf. That's the baseline. That's what you need in order to apply for most things. I would argue that you should not be settling for only three potential advisors, recommendors. Consider that at most universities, students will take 40 classes, 50 classes during the time they're on campus. Each and every one of those courses is taught by a professor who's a potential recommender for you. And if you build relationships with many, or most, or all of them, you will be able to pick and choose strategically when it's letter of recommendation time. Yet another scenario. You decide you want to attend graduate school, let's say in psychology or sociology. Your top choices: Harvard, Princeton, Michigan, Stanford. An impressive list. It just so happens that that list is made up of universities that your recommenders have attended. They're graduates of those four schools. A well-crafted letter from someone who went to Michigan or someone who went to Princeton back to his or her own department would be the most powerful thing you can ask. It would carry so much weight in admissions and so much weight in getting financial aid at those places at your dream schools. So if you have 10 people on campus who would write letters of recommendation, then if you do your due diligence and you see where they've gotten their degrees, you can strategically pick and choose. You want to go to Berkeley. Your favorite professor studied at Berkeley. That would be a wonderful opportunity for you to ask them to recommend you back to their department, because a letter from that person will open up every door conceivable on your behalf. These are the kinds of things that no one tells students. They're satisfied when they get to that number three. I would say you should have 10. I would say you should have 15 or 20, because then you can pick the ones that you want for the individual programs to which you're applying. An important note about graduate and to some degree professional study. you never want to pay for graduate school if you can avoid it. You may already have a lifetime supply of college debt from your undergraduate years. You should be such an outstanding scholar who's been so strategic that you receive a full tuition waiver and a grant and a fellowship and a teaching assistantship or a research assistantship that pays you a real living wage while you complete your graduate degree. No one should ever have to pay for graduate school. By being as scholarly as I hope you will be, you're ensuring that you're saving hundreds of thousands of dollars on your next educational experience. So realize this right from the beginning. I think that should be about enough for today before we go on and talk to our guests. But let me summarize just for a moment about years 2 and 3. It's the time when you're selecting a major. It's the time when you're diving more deeply into that major and exploring what the future will look like for you. It's a time when you'll be doing internships that reveal to you what the life in that career will be like. And it's also, of course, the time that you're building relationships all throughout this period that will lead to those magical letters of recommendation that will open up the doors for you later. Years 2 and 3 is the time to begin to think about life after college. Now you still have plenty of time. You can change your major. You can build new relationships. You can find new things to discover. But years 2 and 3 are serious years. You're not a first year student anymore. It's time to take yourself seriously. So this is the essence of this period of the life of a college student. Having heard enough from me, let's move on and hear from guests. These guests will tell you a little bit about their experience as students and their experience with dealing with students from the faculty perspective. And they're some of the very best to explain these things to you, and we'll meet some of them now. Okay, we've been talking for the past half hour or so about really the core of your college time, the second and third, and perhaps the beginning of your fourth years, after you've been kind of a clueless first-year student, just trying to figure it all out, and you come back for the second year, and you know where to go, and you know where to eat, and you have friends on campus, and now you start to get a little bit more serious about, well, where am I going with my education? What might I choose to major in? Where does my passion lie? And we're pivoting just a little bit from the past pattern of these podcasts, in the sense that I would talk typically to a professor at one point and to a student at another point. And now we have both professor and student together, people who have been partnering in the education fundamentally of one another. I've learned both from my faculty guests and from my student guests that certainly the student learns a great deal from their professors. But what has emerged in this podcast is the degree to which the professor learns from the student, and how powerful it is when we listen to our students and they help us to grow as faculty as we help them to emerge as scholars themselves. So we have today Dr. Holly Barker, who is a professor in anthropology, and Micah Hatchey, who is a former student of hers, who is now working at the University of Washington in a capacity that he will describe. And just having them together today is such a treat for me, since I know Holly for a very long time, and I've watched Micah in a variety of different ways, which I will share with you in a moment, because he's been a University of Washington scholarship football player, which has been part of the interesting evolution of Micah and his discovery of his academic passions. What I would like both of them to do just briefly is introduce a little bit of how they arrived at the university, what their interests were before they arrived here, and so forth. So let's start with Micah as the student. Always put the student in the center of most everything that I do. So Micah, tell us a little bit about growing up in Hawaii and that sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure. But first off, Stan, I want to thank you for having me on here. It's an honor to be part of your podcast along with my professor Holly Barker. But Yeah, my name is Micah. I do come from Hawaii. I was born and raised on the North Shore of Hawaii, of Oahu, to be exact, Haleiwa. But I graduated high school in 2010. Growing up in the islands was paradise to everybody, right? But paradise to me was, it was great. We had so many fun times growing up with my family. Going to school out there was great. There are so many different cultures out there that you can learn from. So growing up in Hawaii, I learned so much from all the different cultures out there. I got to put that into my cultural aspect of growing up, and wherever I went after I graduated, I felt like I could fit in with whoever I met with, of whatever background they were. So I felt like I can understand where they come from, who they are, and kind of get into there a little bit and just be like a friend to them and learn from them. But yeah, after I graduated in 2010, I came to UW on a football athletic scholarship. Coming to UW, it was a culture shock for me because I'm so used to nice, warm weather, the beach, just being around a lot of my family. But when I came up here, summertime was great. It felt like home. But once the seasons changed, that is where everything just changed for me because it just started getting cold. My family's not around. The only family I had were my friends that I made on the football team. But the brotherhood that I made with my friends on the team is what helped me push through. And we took care of each other in that sense. And like a lot of players, when they first step onto campus, they go through highs and lows. And like when we first got to campus, we were like, oh yeah, we're all football players. We're in a college. We're about to play college ball. But then there's times during that season where we hit lows and we get homesick. And like for me, I was fortunate enough to have a really strong brotherhood or bond with the players at that time. And especially for me coming from Hawaii, I had three other Hawaii boys that came with me and we were all in the same class. And what made it even more better is when we got to campus, there were multiple Polynesians or Pacific Islanders on the team. And there were a few other Hawaii boys that were already on the team as well that helped us feel at home. So if we felt like we're homesick, they would pick us up, take us out to go and eat or just hang out and just talk things through and just made sure that we were taken care of. I think getting into the academic side for me, when I first stepped onto campus, I wanted to get into engineering, but going through the engineering, looking at the engineering schedule and the football schedule, they never really matched up for me schedule-wise. So I ended up going undecided my first couple of years, and I took classes that ended up getting into more cultural classes. So I went through American Ethnic Studies. 2012 is when I got into anthropology with Holly. And those classes led me to where I am now, where I went through a lot of cultural classes, learning that I wanted to get more in touch with the cultural aspect of what I wanted to get into. And it led me to a path where I wanted to work with students or the next generation of kids. And I wanted to give back to those kids from the knowledge that I've gained through my high school career, college career, professional career. And like lately, within the past 5, 6 years or so after my little stunt in the NFL after getting hurt, that's where I was trying to find my pathway. And back in Hawaii is where I found that I wanted to work with the next generation of students. And at that time, I was a substitute teacher and a high school football coach. And that got me into what I wanted to do. And fast forward a few years, now I'm a counselor at the University of Washington. I'm working with high school students, trying to help them explore their options into understanding what UW is about and helping them understand that they do belong here at the university. And I'm trying to do my part in helping them apply and hopefully be on campus soon.
It's wonderful.
So, yeah.
And Holly, how did you arrive at the University of Washington?
Yeah, well, first of all, hello, Stan and Micah, and just so nice to join you both in conversation tonight. Thanks for having us, Stan. I came to the University of Washington by accident, really. It definitely was not a plan. At the time, my husband had accepted a job in Seattle, and so we moved out here. And I was working full-time remotely for the government of the Marshall Islands. And I was working for their embassy in Washington, D.C. To build the capacity of Marshallese leaders to go to the U.S. government and advocate for their needs as a result of U.S. colonialism. The work was very difficult, to say the least. It's hard to be in politics. It's challenging. There's a lot of people saying no, regardless of sort of the importance of the issues or the requests. And so I had met Dr. Miriam Khan, who was in the anthropology department at the time, and she asked me to come in and teach one class about applied anthropology and how anthropology functions outside of academia, the way I was thinking about it in the embassy. And I came and did a guest lecture 18 years ago and taught one class. And unexpected, I had no idea that I would love it so much. I didn't always love academics, so I didn't think I'd want to stay around academics for very long. What I forgot about, I think, are the students. As soon as I had a class, like, I love students. I absolutely love students. And from there, I just started growing more and more classes and kind of until I got first a temporary position and then a more permanent position. So I'm now a teaching professor, so I can focus really on the teaching elements. And it really just is an honor and a privilege. I love my job. Right. So happy to talk about it.
How did you both first meet one another? Michael, were you in a class with Holly, or where did the connection come from? How did this happen?
Yeah, so it was 2012. It was one of her classes. Do you remember what class it was that I said this morning?
It was on colonialism and culture.
Colonialism.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. Colonialism and culture. But yeah, that was my first class with Holly. And just the way that she reached out to all the students in there and made it just feel... She made it feel like a homey vibe, I could say. Like, she wasn't like all the other professors where they like kind of make you scared to take a class. She made it feel fun. It was a fun class to take. The way that she went about teaching us, where she taught us in fun ways where it made us interact with each other and just create a bond with the class. And given this class was a mix of student athletes and general students, right? But the way that she had classes go where we intermixed with everybody and just getting us to know the people that were in there, understand where they come from, who they are. It was different than a lot of other classes that I took. And it was just, it felt really good. And it just felt like she made us understand who we are and who we could be and how we could make a difference within a classroom between everyone there. But yeah, 2012 was the first class I took with her.
So I've been preaching to students the importance of going to office hours, meeting faculty, not fearing faculty. It sounds like Holly set up the situation that she was fun. She was not a person to be intimidating to you.
Mm-hmm.
What role, Holly, question to you, what role did Micah play in reaching out to you and building the relationship with you that has led you to become colleagues over the course of time? I mean, was he proactive in seeking you out and seeking your mentorship in any way? You're both laughing, so we're about to get an insider story, I guess.
I think there's always that period in the beginning where students are like, oh, who's this person? And then the teacher's also like, oh, are they really wanting to learn? And, I think we saw that it happens in every class, right? You wait and see who really wants to engage and who doesn't. But I think what became really quickly apparent about Micah, as well as a lot of the people that he was spending time with, is that he thrives in an environment that is like family. And I think that Micah, as you were alluding to earlier, Stan, he taught me how to teach in so many ways by bringing the best of his own family and his own culture and who he is, where relationships are central, are key. And I don't know if Micah knows the effect that he had on me when he would walk in the classroom. And before class every day, he would smile, say hello, how was your day, give me a hug. And I don't think I ever got to tell you, Micah, just how much that,
I didn't know that.
That centered me. And it just, I was always so nervous about teaching. Like, it's such a big job of like, oh my goodness, do I have anything to impart? And I find it like, I want to do well at it so badly that sometimes I just get really nervous about that. And when you walk in and give that smile and just like, how are you? I care about you as a person, regardless of what we're going to talk about academically, about anthropology or culture or anything else. It touched me. And I think it guided me so much in how to run a classroom where if we can invest in each other as family, the way you've done all your life, like you brought the strength of relationships into our institution and guided us with that. And when you can start to treat your fellow classmates and your professors as family, and you invest in each other that way, then you're invested in knowledge making and you're invested in each other's well-being in an entirely different way. And I think you cultivated that. And I think, that and us going on the study abroad together, too, I think just had an incredible impact. Working together with student athlete academic services with, in particular, Inc. Alianga and Liberty Bracken, and developing these study abroad programs so that student athletes and non-student athletes could have a chance for that transformational learning that comes from study abroad. And, Micah, seeing the ways that learning from community elders and knowledge bearers is so important to you your whole life, keeping you just in a classroom would not give you those same kind of chances to learn from people in the ways that you've always learned, right? And so when we did our first study abroad to French Polynesia and seeing you again with all those relationships with our host family that you're calling mama and papa, and with all the community elders who could come in and teach about these issues, that made the learning come alive for you. You had such a vitality, and such a strength of bringing us all together too. And I think there's so many different forms of intelligence, and you've got the academic intelligence, but also that deep social intelligence that's relational, that I think is cultivated by your culture, but is also really cultivated by being on a team and knowing how to work with people from different backgrounds. And you just brought so many different skills to that.
Michael, could you talk briefly about the experience in French Polynesia?
So 2013, the summer of 2013, we went to French Polynesia, Tahiti. It was an awesome experience. And I would say it was kind of a culture shock too, because seeing people who look like me, other Polynesians, but speaking French was a culture shock for all of us. Like when we all got there, we saw everybody, and right when they started speaking to us, we were like, whoa, this is crazy. Because like at first, like we were told that they speak French and Tahitian out there, but I wasn't prepared for how it would actually be, and it was really a culture shock for me. And I like, to me, I thought it was really fascinating because you don't see a lot of Polynesians speaking French, at least from where I come from. But going out there, it was such an awesome experience. We got to stay with our host family, the Lependus. They housed our whole team, and then we got to go out to the communities, teach the locals about American sports. We got to hang out with them, go to some local spots to check out the island. We got to eat some local food. But we had about 10 days to 2 weeks out there just to teach them about American sports, and just pretty much have a fun learning experience with everybody out there. But it was great. It was a fun experience. I've been wanting to go back for a while now. I just haven't been able to.
It'll happen.
Hopefully soon. Hopefully soon.
Mike, I want to ask you a quick question. You were a varsity scholarship football player. Were you encouraged and supported to explore this deep passion that you were developing and all of your academic interests? I mean, I understand that the coaches want to get the best out of you as an athlete. Was the athletic department and your counselors and advisors and coaches supportive of the work you were doing because you were really discovering yourself in a way that was different from your athletic prowess? And you were building relationships with people on campus that went far beyond the athletic department.
No, for sure. They were all very supportive in everything that we did. I think the only part for me that was rough was the beginning when I first got there, because I wanted to get into engineering, but the schedules didn't match up. And then going undecided for my first couple year, my 2 years, my first 2 years there, that was where I kind of didn't know what path I wanted to get into. But just having the support of our counselors, advisors, professors, we were able to take what's called like pre-major category classes. And I found out about like American ethnic studies and anthropology classes and how they tied into like cultural studies. And so at that time, I was really thinking about, what about this class? This sounds really interesting. So I took it, ended up getting into it more and liking it more. And that's kind of how I got into my career now, is just getting into the cultural aspects of the studies, getting to do like hands-on activities in communities, just talking with different community members within the classes and seeing what they do outside in their communities and what we can learn from all those situations that they've gone through. Because in all of our classes, we've gone through a lot of different neighborhoods, North Seattle, Seattle, like South Seattle. We've gone through a bunch of different high and low neighborhoods to learn from. And we've done so many community service projects out there with the football team as well. But just learning from all of those experiences, seeing all the different things that's out there, kind of it got me into where I wanted to help the next generation of students. And like for me, I like to give back the knowledge that I've learned, whether that's through school or sports. And recently, within the past 7 or 8 years, I've been coaching, so I've been giving my knowledge of sports back to the next generations to succeed in the sport that they get into. And for me, it's been mostly football, and I've been doing like camps on during the off season that help these next generation of student athletes know what they're going to get into, what they need to know, and just help them thrive in getting to the next level of their lives. So for me, giving back to the next generation is what I ended up loving to do. And now that I'm in a job where I can reach out to these, so for, let me rewind a little bit. So for my job at UW, I'm a admissions counselor with the Multicultural Outreach and Recruitment Team. So we serve, my team in itself, we serve a lot of the underserved communities, right? So I go to a lot of the school, for me, my schools are in South Seattle. So I go to a lot of the underserved schools in South Seattle to kind of reach out to them and help them understand the application process for UW, and helping them understand that they can make it to UW through like getting scholarships and like community help. But just going out to these schools, talking with these kids is what I would say, it brings me joy, because like I go out to these schools and I give presentations about the university, about the admissions process and all that stuff. But what I see helps these kids kind of light up is when I tell them who I am, and I tell them that I'm a former football player. And like when I tell them that, automatically their attention just looks right at me and they start like listening to me and what I say. And what is pretty cool is after my presentation, these kids come up to me, they ask me questions about how to apply, how to get all of these, their questions for the financial aid and scholarships in. And I even have some athletes that come into my presentations and they ask me about, what do I need to do to be looked at? What do I need to do to be a scholarship athlete or just get to the next level doing sports? And when I get those kind of questions after a presentation, it's like, okay, this is what I like to do. I want to help you get to the next level in your life, whether that's through sports or through the education platform, or if that's even the workforce after high school. If I can do something to help you take the next step of your career in a positive way, that's what I like to do. Like, I want to just help the next generation be as successful as it can be.
Right. Holly, you are a recipient of the university's Distinguished Teaching Award. which is the Professor of the Year Award.
As are you, Stan.
Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. Why do you invest so much of your time and effort in teaching and mentoring when universities typically reward their faculty for primarily their research and their publications and their grant acquisitions? You've chosen to invest in MICA and people like MICA. What motivates you to do that?
Yeah. Well, honestly, Stan, you had a big role in mentoring me about how to approach teaching too, and the importance of approaching teaching like service. And, you know, we're at a public university, and public universities have a mission to make sure that everybody gets the best possible education. We are in service to our students. They come to us to strengthen their skills so that they can be as well equipped as possible to lead their communities and help us navigate the future. And it's the obligation. It's, you know, as Micah was saying, it's that sense of a sense of joy from helping to equip the next generation. And the same way that Micah was saying, like, it gives him joy to do that for students. It gives me joy to see Micah in that position, because I know all the young people that he's connecting with are with the best possible person who could do that. And so you start to see that ripple effect, right? If you invest in Micah and cultivate his skills and then see all the lives that he's able to touch from that, it feels hopeful, right? That you're growing something larger than you could ever do by yourself, by activating the knowledge and the leadership and the passion of the students. It brings me joy too. I feel, since I've been working with Micah and the students, I feel that a sense of family has grown. I feel that my heart has grown. My sense of love has grown. I have so many students that I love. Like, being able to say that too is not something you often see in academia. And I think the Polynesian students in particular really taught me to embrace the idea of love as part of the classroom. And it's okay to come and give a big hug and say, love you, have a good day. And how that shifts relationships about learning, because I do feel invested as an auntie in the same way that it's a, for the older generation where I am now, the task is just to equip the next generation. It's not about me. It's not about myself. It's about equipping that next generation. And that's how we pass knowledge from generation to generation. So I see it as a responsibility, the mentoring, the teaching, the surface aspects of it. It's our responsibility. I'm fortunate to have it.
Yeah. Well, Micah, you played for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and now you're recruiting students to come to the university. Holly informed me that you had an event at the Intellectual House where 400 mm-hmm. students from Pacific Island Heritage came to the university and began to think of themselves as potential Huskies on yeah. campus. Frankly, I'd have to think this is engineering's loss, that this is what you've discovered. So congratulations to you. Too bad for the engineers of the world, but there's a whole generation of students who will benefit. I guess the final word I wanted to ask for both of you in a very brief sort of way is, you've got the floor. You have students out there who, as in Micah's case, he wanted to be an engineer. It was a challenge for a variety of different reasons. He pivoted to something that has become his life's work. And it's so gratifying to see him immersing himself in his life's work. For both of you, as a kind of a last statement, what would you advise students today What would you tell them to do? They've been given this opportunity. In this case, Micah, your students, your 400 students get admitted to the university. What do you advise them? What do you tell them to do with regard to the education that's being made available to them? And the same question to Holly, what would you tell your students to take fullest advantage of this wonderful opportunity to learn? Micah, you could go first.
Okay. For students coming to the university and trying to find a career path that they want to get into, I think the biggest thing that I would have to say is find something that you're passionate about, something that you would love to do for the rest of your life, or something that you want to do to make a difference in people's lives, you know? Because honestly, the past 8 years or so after my injury from the NFL sidelined me, it was a tough road to go through, because I was trying to make it back to the NFL, trying to play again. But then at the same time, I'm also seeing like time is ticking away where I need to start my life. Like, I wanted to get back in the NFL and play so badly that that's all I focused on. But time for, like, my days were ticking away where I wasn't getting a call. I wasn't getting anything going for my athletic career, that I started thinking about my future. And like, I started getting into things that I wanted to do for the rest of my life, which was give back to the next generation and get them understanding what they need to do to be successful for the next phases of their life.
Well, too bad for the NFL much, and too bad for engineering, yeah. I guess.
Man, yeah, it was tough. It was a tough road for me at the time. And I mean, like, sure, there's still days where I think of it, I'm like, man, I could still be playing. But then I'm still like, no, it's okay. I love what I do now. I love giving back, you know. But yeah, it was a tough transition. But my advice to the future generations is find something that you're passionate in and something that will make you happy. Because whatever you get into, if you're happy, then it's not a job. You're just living your life, you know? But if you go and get into a job that doesn't make you feel good or happy, or if it just drains you, you need to find what you want to be happy with within that job. So like all the jobs that I get into, I try and find like if it was a job that wasn't fun to me, I would try and find something positive about it and try to make it fun. And for me, fortunately, this job is a great role for me, and I do love what I do with the students that I work with and my team that I work with. We all just relate to each other and one another, and it's not work for me. It's just a fun life right now.
Great.
You know? So, yeah, I love what I do and find the happiness in everything, you know? Learn to love what you do.
It's a great attitude. Holly, your final comment as far as your advice to students?
Well, nothing makes me happier, Micah, than hearing you say you have a fun life. That's its own reward. And I guess I would tell students that some of the most important learning that they have on campus is outside of the academic contents. Yes, there's the curriculum and the major and the classes, but the importance of doing things like study abroad or engaging in research, meeting people who are outside your friend group, getting to know people of different generations, like different having relationships with professors who are adults, who are different from your parents, who invest in you in different ways. And I think that's really important, that a college degree is so much more than the classes that you take. I think engaging in research helps people find the depths of their curiosity, as well as to cultivate their skills too. And so finding what they're curious about and asking professors what they're working on and if they can get involved. I would want students to not be afraid of professors and talking to us, and know that it's always going to be the best part of my day is talking to a teacher. And I can, when I get, I'm sorry, is talking to the students. The best part of my day is always talking to the students. It's not doing the requirements of my department. It's not doing the other work that has part of critical parts of the university life. But anytime a student comes in, it's going to be the best part of my day. And I'd encourage students to think about engaging with the university from their places of strength. And I think with Micah, his culture and his family are such sources of strength. And so finding disciplines, finding research that can be done in a collective approach, where you can launch from your places of strength rather than from places where you feel, I don't know, not at your best. And so for Micah and a lot of the student athletes and a lot of the Pacific Islanders, coming to the Burke Museum, for instance, and doing research where they can hold community members or familiar to their homes enables them to center their strengths and to feel good and to feel grounded and feel connected. And I think for every student, there are going to be different places to find that connection. And if they're having problems finding it, talk to us. There are always the counselors, the teachers, the peers and others who are always happy to help steer them that way. But I think most of all, we want students to be themselves, that they come to us just filled with so many strengths, and we need them. We need them to be their themselves and to bring that to the university and share themselves with us. And that's where I think we get to build something different for the future by bringing all the unique qualities of students and bringing them into campus life. I don't know. That's it. That's all I can.
Wonderful. Well, to hear a relationship between a faculty person and a student, to understand, especially in Micah's case, that he clearly never feared you if he would greet you in the way that he greeted you, is so uplifting for me. And it's something that I've been trying to propose to our students who may or may not be listening to this podcast. But I want to thank you both for being so refreshingly honest and candid and sharing this stuff, some of which is so clear is heartfelt. I mean, the level of authenticity and sincerity on both of your parts just kind of rises to the surface, and any student who hears what the possibilities could be for their relationships with faculty and students, two-way street, should really be informative so that these things are available to them and they should pursue them with vigor. So thank you both.
Thank you so much,
thank you, folks.
Thank you, Micah.
Good to see you both.
Go Dogs.
You're a great story. Go Dogs is right. Just as a preview of episode 10, which is basically the last in this central series of podcasts, this is the last year. This is your senior year. Now, it may be the fourth year for some of you, or the fifth, or the sixth. But the fact is, this is how you wrap up your college career. There are some amazing things that happen in the last year. It's a time for you to celebrate what you've achieved, but it's certainly not time to take a victory lap before it's over. And we'll talk more deeply about the essence of that last year of college and how that sets you up for life in your postgraduate days. So I'll see you next time.
Extracurricular in Particular.
A podcast from Dr. Stan Chernikov. Thank you for listening to this installment. Please check back for new episodes. And as always, subscribe, rate and review so we can be popular with the algorithms. Produced by Matthew Chernikov, Dr. Stan Chernikov's son. Deepfake Talkbot co-host provided by Fake You. Until next time, extracurricular in particular. Over and out.